Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. On today's episode, episode 132, Inciting a Slavic Riot, I am so pleased to present to you an interview with author, artist, scholar, so many wonderful things that you will find out about during the interview, Melissa Ivanko. I have been in correspondence with her for a really long time, and I have been so impressed with her work, her scholarship, on a broad, huge, wide range of topics, but specifically her work in exploring Slavic folklore and Russian language and you know, just sort of this whole miasma of folklore and spiritual practices that aren't normally talked about or discussed in Western conversations around paganism. So I was really excited to sit down and have a conversation with her. But before we get into that, I did want to go ahead and remind you that we are a Patreon-supported podcast. Thank you so much to all current Patreon subscribers. Remember, if you'd like to support independent pagan media, you can give as little as a dollar per creation at patreon.com/incitingprojects. You get cool things like unedited audio and video clips. You get to listen to episodes weeks before they air. And every now and then you get some cool little extras from myself and my co-host on Inciting a Brouhaha, Velma Nightshade. So if you are interested, you can give as little as a dollar per creation, like per episode, at patreon.com/incitingprojects. Remember that links for anything you hear during the show are going to be in the show notes at incitingariot.com. Thanks so much for listening. And now here's the interview. Oh, thank you so much for coming on to the show today here at Inciting a Riot. Melissa, for folks that don't know, you do a whole lot of a whole lot of things. Presence is broad. You are an author, you are a scholar, you are a translator, you are a short story writer. My gosh, you just created a tarot set. What don't you do, and when do you sleep?
Well, what don't I do is I don't knit. I tried that a couple times and I'm very, very bad at it. So that I've given up on. I also don't do math particularly well. And as for when I sleep, almost never.
Well, and the not doing math and the not knitting thing makes sense, because I'm told that there's math involved with that. I don't know. I looked at the needles and they just stared at me and gave me that look. And they said, you know, not to mess with us. So I didn't. So let's dive in. So I'm really curious. A lot of folks, you know, around this time of year, this wintry time of year, pass around a lot of fun lists of other winter holiday figures. And it sort of always leads to, you know, creepy, crazy Eastern European, Russian folklore entities. And I know absolutely no one that is a scholar of that very specific type of folklore. And then yet here you are. So Melissa, tell the folks out there listening what it is that you study, you know, the broad reach of it.
Sure. So I'm currently a PhD candidate in Slavic languages and literature, with a focus on the woman warrior archetype and folklore. But I've also read quite a bit of Soviet socialist realism and other propaganda fiction, particularly by women writers. Most people who are familiar at all with Slavic, and particularly Russian literature, know Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and that's about it. But there are many, many more Russian writers out there that have some fantastic works. And even among other Slavic scholars, very few have actually read any of the women writers. So there's been a trend recently with scholars trying to reclaim some of those. So as for what initially got me into studying Russian anyway, it was the folklore. So I've always been a mythology nut ever since second grade when we did a section in one of my classes on Egyptian mythology. Excuse me, putting my cat down. And then I started taking Latin and discovered the Romans and fell in love with them. And then I discovered the Celts later in high school. And also while studying Latin, I fell in love with just studying languages in general. So I started learning German and French as well. And then when I got to college the first time, they only offered 7 languages. And while I wanted to study Slovak, because that's my own family's heritage, well, that and Scottish, but I'm mostly Slovak. So, but my university didn't offer Slovak, but they offered Russian. And I figured that's close enough. It's still Eastern European, still a Slavic language. So I started studying that and, of course, fell in love with it and discovered their fairy tales.
So, you know, you sort of walked us through the... I think the daisy chain of mythology that a lot of people take. I mean, you know, in sixth grade, you take your social studies course and somewhere along there is a 1 week stint of Greek mythology. And so, you know, I feel like when people think of mythology, the default for some reason, I don't know, is Greek mythology. I don't really know why that's the default, but people think, you know, that, okay, mythology is Greek mythology. And then you might get into some Roman mythology because it's Greek mythology, but different names and slightly more polite.
They're so different and no one appreciates that.
If you're really cool, you get into Egyptian mythology and maybe some Norse, especially because, thank you, Marvel, which has nothing to do with mythology except for the names. But, like, I think the only thing, I mean, the only thing that I can think of that I would even remotely say that I know about Russian mythology, Slavic mythology, is Baba Yaga? Maybe? Is that a thing?
She is. She's a very well-known figure. I actually wrote my honors thesis on Baba Yaga as a symbol of initiation into adulthood during my first time at the university. So she's a very fascinating figure. Some have actually traced her back to an old chthonic deity who then, as Russia and Eastern Europe in general became Christianized, thanks in large part to Cyril and Methodius, Baba Yaga then got transformed kind of into just a folkloric figure who sometimes eats children, sometimes helps them, but always transforms them in some manner.
And she lives in a house with chicken feet. That's all I know.
Absolutely.
There's always a house. It walks around on chicken feet, and there's a creepy, creepy fence. Sometimes it's made out of bones. This is the sum total of my knowledge of Russian folklore and mythology.
There's so much more to it.
So I was going to ask, like, give me a crash course. What else should, like, where should I start learning? Because it's fascinating me that there is so much more out there. Because I didn't even have a concept of Russian mythology.
And most don't. So you're certainly not alone in that. They have pagan Russia had a whole slew of deities that in many ways are similar to the Norse view. There's a lot of shared concepts there. The Slavs had an idea of the world tree as well, usually perceived as an oak. And they had several primary deities depending on which area of Slavdom you were in. I'm most familiar with the Russian names, although there's a lot of crossover between the South Slavs and the North Slavs and the East and West Slavs. And of course, the many other cultures, because they are even more of a polyglot from the very beginning than America is for various reasons. And there was also the whole colonization issue, but that's besides the fact. So at the top of the world tree in most Slavic understandings of their pagan pantheon is Perun, who's sort of not quite your stereotypical sky thunder god, but he has a lot of those qualities. He's generally depicted with a big copper beard and copper-colored hair, and he carries a double-bladed battle axe. He's associated with thunder and lightning and the storms, and he rules from the branches of the world tree. His enemy and brother is Veles, who rules from the roots of the world tree. He's kind of your typical underworld fertility deity, and he has a strong affiliation with cattle. And then there are many other gods in between. Dashbog, god of the sun, Svarog, god of earthly fire, usually associated with the forge. You have Marana, or Marzana, depending on where you're at, Morena sometimes, who's sort of your death goddess. I'd often compare her to the Morrigan, who people are more familiar with because their domains are very similar. You have Mulcash, who's generally described as the goddess of all women's things. She's associated with the spindle and weaving and all sorts of textile and weaving crafts, as well as being the handmaiden of Mother Earth, or Matisira Zemlya. Literally that translates to Mother Moist Earth. Those I'd say would be the, the basics. There's a lot more out there, but those are the highlights, and those are probably the ones who are most well known.
So I know that different mythological pantheons, cultures had different ideas of gender and relationships and women's rights, power dynamics, things like that. Where does Russian folklore sort of stack up? I mean, are we, you know, a wild Bacchanalian time like the Greeks? Are we just very like chill like the Nordic? Are we very orderly like the Egyptians? Like, what's going on with it?
That's a complicated question because it changes based on what era. So in very early Slavic paganism and folklore, particularly with the Bellini cycles of the folktales, you have not quite a perfectly egalitarian understanding of gender relations, but you had male warriors, the Bagatiri, and then you also had the female warriors, the Palinitsi. Who sometimes were or sometimes became the wives of the Bagatiri in the different cycles of folklore. So there's that, but then as it progressed, particularly after the Christianization, it became understandably more patriarchal. And even today, it's a very conservative society compared to what we're used to, and their sort of worldview of even their own paganism, which they're actually more familiar with than you would expect most Westerns to be with our own sort of understanding of where we came from. Perun's still a pretty common household name, despite the fact that no one's really worshipped him in about 1,000 years. Except for the now revival of Radnaviria and like the Slavic native faith, basically. There's been a huge resurgence of Slavic paganism in particular in each of the different countries.
So talking about paganism, I you know, modern pagans have this spectrum of hard polytheist to soft polytheist to atheist, The hard polytheist says each of these gods is literally real and, you know, they're somewhere and they're doing their thing. And then the soft polytheist is like, oh, more the idea of separate deities. And then, you know, all the other theisms. I'm always really interested in the perspective of a scholar when pagans approach a... pop filter. when pagans approach a new mythology and they find a deity that they sort of feel like they jive with and they want to get to know more. As a scholar, how do you recommend that people try to build a relationship with a deity?
Goodness. I'm personally, I take a more druidic approach. I'm a member of ADF. And I have been for several years now. So with that, it's because it's very academic and scholarly based, which I obviously appreciate. So our general understanding of how to build and maintain relationships with deity is that it's reciprocal. So you can't just go to a deity you've never worked with and ask for a favor, because it would be the same as approaching a stranger on the street and asking for a favor. Most of them are going to be like, "Who the heck are you? Get away from me. Why would I help you?" So it helps to start with establishing that relationship through offerings. I would say if you want to approach the Slavic deities, and from my own work, I found they're very receptive. I think in large part because they were ignored for so long, especially by those outside of the particular Slavic countries. So they are very receptive in my own experience. And I mostly work with the Zarya, who as characters in,
American Gods.
I think
I
it
was
was,
gonna say, I do know a couple of other figures. I just remembered. My favorite work of
So
fiction.
they've become better known, and they're fabulous to work through. I found they are very, very helpful in my divinations. They help give incredibly clear answers, like clearer than anyone else I've ever worked with. And they're very kind in the blessings they bestow. And my deities, of course, receive a lot of vodka as their primary offerings.
So, I'm always curious to sort of ask this question of lots of different kinds of pagan people and scholars and folks that work with different kinds of spirits and deities and entities and ancestors and things like that, because very often the modern pagan way of interacting with somebody is to plug and play a deity. I'm doing a love spell, so I'm really interested in Slavic folklore these days. Who's the Slavic goddess of love? Let me just stick her name right here and go forth. In your experience, plugging and playing, do you find that these deities, that these entities fit into nice, neat categories? This is the goddess of love. This is the god of fishing. This is the so and so.
Yes and no. Some of them fit fairly well. Like Mokush, for example, if you want to improve your handicrafts or do any kind of work in that direction, I'm not sure why you would particularly need magic for that, but maybe if you just want someone to facilitate your knitting project, and give you like that boost of creativity in that realm, Mokush would fit very, very well. If you're doing any kind of protection, or if you're a warrior of some variety, a soldier, and you want to kind of bring that energy more into your life, there are several different Slavic deities that you could actually kind of plug and play with. And the plug and play method is certainly how I started on my little pagan journey, but it's evolved somewhat, as one would expect, over 15 years now.
So when, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
sorry, no. But with a lot of the deities, there's a lot of crossover between them, and their associations are still rather broad. So you could access them, I guess, or ask them to facilitate your own rituals and magic work in several different ways in several different areas, even for a single deity. So,
So,
and I think I'm done now.
if folks want to go beyond that sort of plug and play method and really delve into maybe not a scholarly approach because we can't all get doctorates in Slavic folklore, but if folks do want to do a deeper dive, do you have any recommendations for books, for YouTube channels, for a really nice smoke signal that gives great information?
Oh, goodness. There's a lot of resources I've consulted over the years, and there's actually a lot online that you can find. The articles on Wikipedia actually are very accurate. There's a couple things that are a little iffy, but it certainly makes a good starting point because they have pages devoted to most of the well-known deities, or at least the ones whose mythology and folklore has survived to the modern age. And there are a couple good books out there. Most of the ones I know are in Russian, since it's not as popular of a topic here in the West. So I don't know that most of those, my book recommendations would be very helpful to the larger part of your audience. But there is a book in particular that I would recommend that's very scholarly, but it's still readable, I would say, by the non-PhD candidate. Because it was written in order to be accessible to everyone, and that's Magic in Russia. And it basically covers, it's a thick book, but it covers the whole spectrum of folk magic in particular, that which was practiced in large part by the peasantry, although the aristocracy certainly appreciated divination, and the reading of tarot cards and tea leaves were very popular activities even up through like the 19th century. And today, I still know many who do that today in Russia and other parts of Eastern Europe. So those kind of practices never really died out because there's the principle of like the dvayaverie, the dual faith. So even after Christianity became a thing in Russia, there was still a lot of practice of folk magic and things like that. So Magic in Russia covers that topic. Broad as it is, very, very well.
So I do want to turn to your books, but before I do, and while we're talking about deities, it is a wintry time of year, and there's all sorts of really fun creatures out there. Oh my God, and one of them is eating something right now. Stop it. There's all sorts of fun creatures out there that, like eat babies for being bad and all sorts of stuff. What is like some really fun Yuletidy time of year folklore that folks should look up because it's so much fun and weird?
I'm in, well, goodness. So particularly associated with the winter, very well-known tale is Snegurochka, the snow maiden, which is kind of similar to the Germanic version. She is the niece in some cases, or granddaughter, it depends who you ask, of Deb Mróz, Father Frost. And in other works, she is a sort of snow person come to life when you have the old childless couple who want a daughter and they build a snow person and it turns into the snow maiden Snegurochka. So that's a very interesting, most of the time, happy ending tale. Of course, there's the version where she gets married and she's very like cold and distant and her husband cheats on her and so she like leaves. But there's all kinds of versions of folk tales, as I'm sure you understand. As for creatures
See,
who eat babies.
that is the dark and gritty Frosty the Snowman reboot that I desperately want.
There's a lot of great movies, and some like children's cartoons who, of course, downplay the darker versions. But there was a very good Soviet adaptation that you can find on YouTube, and I'm sure there's a version with English subtitles available. Might take some digging to find it, but it's there.
I'm so excited, but I'm also excited to talk about your books. You are a prolific writer. You've written many books. So,
Well,
but now your books are not, I mean, they are scholarly in the sense of they do pull from your studies, they do pull from your wheelhouse, but they are fiction. Tell me about them.
So my first book came out in 2015. It's called Destined, and it is a they're fun fantasy adventure novels is usually what I go for. Granted, the series, because I'm a huge nerd, I have the entire thing planned out and all my plots established and where everything is going. So I can say it gets darker as it progresses and as my characters grow up and enter adulthood. Because in the first book, they're around 18 or so, most of them. And they do draw loosely anyway from Slavic mythology and folklore. And I adapt that with my study of folklore and mythology in general and other pantheons. So I tend to blend my deity characters when they appear. They're different qualities, but I usually use more the Slavic incarnation of those. But they're mostly fun fantasy adventure romps through my fictional world of Aoria.
So, would you say that this is for lovers of Percy Jackson with a Slavic flair, or is it darker? Are we killing people?
I'm not killing people yet, but it is coming. Because again, my characters start around age 18 and they're fairly innocent and their first journey is fairly innocent. But I mean, there is some eating by dragons and things like that. But it doesn't get too dark until later books. There's certainly, in the book I'm currently writing, Hidden, there's definitely a darker undercurrent. And I don't want to give too much away. I like to explore also legacies between generations and between cultures. So there's sort of a double running parallel narrative in each of my stories, one that tends to be in the present and one that tends to be in the past, and where they mirror and kind of influence each other, because time is a funny thing when you travel between worlds, because it doesn't always travel at the same pace. So there's that kind of relationship. I would say if you're a fan maybe of Patricia MacKillop or Juliette Marillier, those have been my most influential writers that I've read. I love their work, all of it. It's amazing. But there is, again, that kind of, I'm a very sarcastic person, so there's a lot of sarcasm. And what I find humorous in my stories and what I'm told other people have found humorous as well. So it's a mix of the light and the dark, in short.
And I always love a good mix of light and dark. You are one of my favorite folks to interact with on social media, mostly because we tend to do a lot of insane things at the same time, like attempt to do Inktober and, spin lots and lots of plates in the air at the same time. You are also an artist, and an artist that I love your line work. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. One day you're going to put out an adult coloring book. I have never purchased an adult coloring book, but I would buy yours. Your art is also the cover art for your own books, which is phenomenal. But your art is also, highly influenced by folklore and your own studies and things like that. Where do you find inspiration? Where do you, come up with ideas and the themes that you explore in your art?
Oh, goodness. A lot of it, as you have noticed, does trace back to the Slavic mythology and folklore. It really does. There's so many fun creatures and entities that exist in, like, the high style Slavic painters and things like that, people who are much better than I am with a brush. I try, but I don't think I'll ever quite be at that level. Sadko, for instance. So it's a very famous painting in Russia. But there's so many fun things to explore in that realm. I'm still, one of my favorite drawings that I did was the Leshy for last Inktober, which is a fun forest spirit, demon, as he's often portrayed in more modern versions of the folklore, but initially just kind of a semi-benign, semi-malevolent forest creature. They're generally depicted as blue-skinned with a green beard, and they're kind of small and gnome-like, and they stalk through the forest. And if you, there was one folk belief that every time you entered a forest, you had to take off all your clothes, hang them on a tree, and then put them back on backwards and inside out to protect you from the leshy.
Obviously.
But you could also...
Obviously.
Right? It totally makes sense. Because they, like many other creatures in Slavic folklore, will tickle you to death. Like, so I... Once I discovered that, I credited my deep, deep dislike of being tickled with my own ethnic heritage.
I'm sorry.
So I blame.
I just, nope. We're going to have to go back to this. I just need to stop for a moment here, rioters. Can you run that by me one more time? There is I'm going to use your words here. There is a common theme in Slavic mythology, common, where beings tickle you to death.
Yes, generally as a punishment for disrespecting them or just not complying with the rules, because it's very rule based.
Yeah. So you're tickled to death.
Punishment. Tickled to death, yes. The leshy will do that. The Vadyanoi sometimes, if he doesn't drown you. Same with the Drusalki. Normally they drown you, but they can tickle you to death if they're more the land-based variety. And the Drusalka is another fun figure. But the leshy, on the positive side, can also teach you magic. So that's interesting. You just go through the woods. You come to a nice spot. You bend over and put your head between your legs.
Obviously.
And you call... Yeah, naturally. And you, while looking backwards, you call for the leshy to come teach you magic.
Sure.
And if he likes you, he will comply. And if not, he will, you know, tickle you to death.
Does it ever explain the mechanics of being tickled to death?
Not that I've encountered, no.
Okay. So part of your PhD, can I bestow... Like, I'm going to be like a fairy here and bestow a quest on you. I need to understand the mechanics between Slavic fairies tickling people to death. Please and thank you, if you don't mind. I'm just going to need that.
I will try my best.
Thank you so much.
I will try my best in my research.
So...
But no promises.
You and I have also had a lot of conversations over the years because you're not just a scholar, you're not just an artist, you're not just, you know, all of the many things. You actually have this really incredibly interesting life. You are, I mean, in addition to all of the other things that make it really interesting, you are in the military as well.
Yes. So that university I went to that only offered 7 languages at the time was the United States Military Academy.
So how long have you been with the military?
So if you count my West Point time, which I don't, it would be a little over 12 years. But since because I graduated in 2011, so I've been serving on active duty since then. I'm actually getting out in about a year or two. Paperwork pending, because of course nothing in the military moves quickly. But yes.
So one, how do you balance being a PhD candidate with, you know, the military?
So I'm fortunate right now in that I'm part of a program in which the Army is funding my tuition, and I kind of just get to pretend to be a civilian for while I'm getting my master's. And then after I complete my master's, the university I'm attending will actually take over the tuition, and I'll just teach a couple courses in an exchange, basically.
Well, that's nice. You get a little bit of a break.
I do.
So,
which is needed.
how does your military experience sort of inform your spirituality, your religion? I mean, because I've found that, you know, there is nothing about any job that I've ever had that hasn't at least informed the way that I interact with my own spiritual path. You know, even in retail, I found that it sort of drove me in different directions because of, you know, what you need to get out of your spirituality, you know, in different kinds of situations. Being in the military, I mean, you know, the only thing that I have to compare it to is policing, and it's nowhere near the same stress level. And I, you know, I can't imagine the kinds of directions that has taken you. So how has that influenced your relationship with deity and your relationship with your own personal path?
Well, first, a quick comment on your law enforcement. I'm actually both. I'm a military police officer.
Of course.
So I have that aspect as well. Yes. In the words of everyone's favorite warrior princess, I have many skills. But as for how it's influenced my spirituality, unsurprisingly, I've always been very drawn towards working with the warrior archetype of deity. So and the hunter too. So back when I was first starting out, I was, of course, drawn to Diana and Minerva. Now that I'm mostly working within the Slavic pantheon, I work with Giovanna as well, whose name, by the way, etymologically is not related to Diana. It's related to the word for maiden, because she has many similar aspects, but the Dieva root from, you know, in the Russian Dievushka, which means, you know, young woman. So that's where Giovanna comes from, or Giovanna stresses, you know, difficult.
Have you ever found it difficult? I mean, I know that, you know, Circle Sanctuary did a really great service for pagans in America, you know, years ago by petitioning to get the pentacle to be allowed onto military headstones. I know from, you know, research that the military tends to be a little bit more accepting of a place for people of different religious backgrounds, for people of different you know, faiths and faith groups and things like that. For all of its flaws and for all of the different kinds of groups that don't fit neatly into the military, it tends to be a pretty accepting place for religion, at least according to the research that I've done. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes, for the most part. And generally the only people who've given me any pushback, because I'm fairly open with my spiritual preferences, I actually, when I was stationed at my most recent location prior to coming here for grad school, I was actually a distinguished faith group leader, which is what the Army allows for. Religious and spiritual preferences for soldiers that basically don't align with the big three, that we don't have chaplains in the service for. So then they can get mostly volunteers, those who are qualified to lead ritual or service within their religion. So the open circle that we had at my previous duty station, I led it because there wasn't really anyone else. But we had a pretty solid group. And then most of the bigger installations will have an open circle or something equivalent, which Circle Sanctuary is often the sponsor for.
they are everywhere. They are everywhere, and they are a great supporter of the military, of everybody. I mean, they're a wonderful resource for the modern community.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad to know that you haven't experienced sort of any you know, strife with your faith group. Being in the military, have you noticed any growth? I mean, I think that a lot of people see the news and current events and things like that, and only hear headlines and only see what people in charge say about the military or what they want the military to be or something like that. Being in the military, have you found it to be a fairly accepting place, generally speaking? I mean, where are we in terms of modernity inside of the military, just from your perspective?
From what I've seen and from the soldiers I've led and worked with and everyone else that I've interacted with in the military, I'd say we're a heck of a lot more tolerant and accepting of all walks of life than, number one, we're generally given credit for in the media. And number two, even more so than just the regular civilian environment. Historically, the military has always been at the forefront of integration. They were one of the first large organizations to actually integrate by race back in the day. And they were one of the first large organizations to fully integrate by gender as well, particularly with, you know, in the Army and in other branches of the service. It doesn't matter your gender or any kind of race or preferences. We all get paid the same and our payment is public. You can look it up online. So we are truly egalitarian in that regard. And since they've opened up the additional combat branches, particularly infantry, women can now serve in those as well. And there have been several amazing pioneering women who have met the requirements and gone into those aspects of service. So again, like the only real pushback that I've ever received for my gender and for in general being a smaller person physically was at the very beginning of my career when I was still a West Point cadet, because it's, you know, there's some more conservative patriarchal tendencing people out there, you know, like the military is like any other walk of life. You have your jerks within it and you have your kind of fossils, but that's always been an individual person problem. It's never been systemic. Systemically, I've always been taken care of, and systemically, I would say the general soldier has too. And again, when you have issues, it's from an individual person. It's not from the organization at large. And the vast majority of everyone I've interacted with has been very accepting, because it doesn't matter what the person next to you looks like or thinks like or feels like. You have to cover each other's backs. And that creates a really strong bond. And so, yeah, I would say we're actually a lot more open than anyone would think.
I think that's good for a lot of people to hear. I mean, I know that this isn't really going to be a political discussion, but I think that it's good for people to understand that the military is more than just the people they see on TV. It's more than the headlines that they see. Mm-hmm. It's more than, you know, the opinion of a couple of people at the very, very top. I mean, it is a very mm-hmm. large, it's what the largest employer of people in the United States, I think. It's the largest employer. I mean, you know, to throw a statistic out, it's the largest employer mm-hmm. of trans people in the United States. I mean, it's known to be an incredibly inclusive environment by the people that are inside of it. My dad was in the Navy and he, you know, was always a, for all of his faults, he was always like, you know, the actual service men and women themselves are very, very different than the people at the top, the people that you see on TV. So I don't know what that says about who the people that get in power are and how they got there and why they got there, if they don't reflect the actual populace, but it
I'm sure they were reflective at the time that they were coming up. The organization's always changing, and we are a product of our environment at the time we're in it. So, and that's probably about all I can say in that regard.
Of course. So you are, like you said, you're going to be getting out of the military here pretty soon. You're a PhD candidate. You'll have your doctorate pretty soon. Where is life taking you, Melissa Ivanko?
Well, I'm not really sure at this point.
You mean you don't have absolutely every step of the rest of your life figured out? You are a very good millennial. You are.
Yes. And I'm very much within the millennial generation. I have all of my books planned, but not my own life.
Some exciting projects that I know that are on the horizon for you. You just released a tarot deck, the Slavic Tarot, which I, you know, mm-hmm. saw links for posted online. Tons of people are excited about it. I know that decks are limited. Mm-hmm. Where did the idea for the Slavic Tarot come from? What can people expect when they get the deck?
So I first got the idea for the Slavic Tarot deck about 8 or so years ago at this point, when I was searching for one and I couldn't find it. Because I had, you know, there's Celtic decks. There's a ton of Celtic decks. There's Egyptian decks. There's Norse decks. There's all kinds of different tarot decks you can get based on different cultural backgrounds and pantheons. And that was when I first started looking into more the Slavic side of things. And I searched everywhere. I went to every pagan and New Age shop that I could find. I Googled everything online, checked all of my different resources, and could not find any remotely Slavic related deck anywhere. So I started thinking, well, I'm an artist, I'm a writer, I'm probably uniquely qualified in the academic sense to pursue this. So I just started making it, and I started putting the ideas together and like researching which deities and folkloric figures I wanted to align with each of the major arcana, how I wanted to depict the minor arcana. And over the course of about 6 years, I finally got my list together. And then after last year's, like the 2018 Inktober, when I kind of really got back into drawing and my art and sort of experimented with the Copic markers and illustrating in general, I decided to heck with it. I'm just going to make the art. And so in a big blur of a couple months, I just started drawing, and they just came out at me, and the different art for the different cards just spilled out, and it was really easy. And you can actually get those too. I am selling the originals on my Etsy shop. And then I just figured out how to get the cards printed and get them boxed, and here we are.
So if people want to find your tarot deck, your books, where is your web presence? How can people get more Melissa Ivanko?
The easiest way to get links to all of my other websites and media presences is just through my main website, which is just maimurray.com. So Mike Alpha India, Mike Uniform, Romeo Romeo Alpha Yankee.com.
Just had to throw that out there. Just dropping that, dropping the military alphanumeric.
It's the easiest way to convey letters.
I love it. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for being here today. I'm so excited for everything that's on the horizon for you. I'm excited for your new book. I'm excited for the tarot. And I'm excited to see, you know, the continued output from you in the pagan community and the community at large regarding your scholarship. It's such a unique field that nobody else is covering. So I'm so excited that you are out there, that you are doing these things, that you are doing this work. Writers, please go show Melissa some love. You know, go get that tarot deck. My gosh, it's so cool. The art is beautiful. And the artist is pretty freaking cool, as you can tell. Her books are available online. Links to everything will be in the show notes. I am going to leave you, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.